From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Mr. President, you exhibit all the signs of a petty and cruel dictator.
Nothing that is going on in Iran will justify an attack against Iran. And the U.S. is using all this hullabaloo about Ahmadinejad to whip up public opinion for an attack against Iran.
But regretfully, two or three monopolistic powers, selfish powers, want to force their word on the Iranian people and deny them their right.
Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad speaks at Columbia University ahead of his UN address. Hundreds rally for and against his visit. The university president excoriates him from the podium. The Iranian leader's visit comes amidst ongoing speculation of a possible U.S. military strike on Iran. We'll speak with Professor Ervand Abrahamian, author of Targeting Iran, and with Trita Parsi, author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States. Then we look at Burma, where the ruling military junta is facing the most vocal popular uprising against its rule in nearly two decades. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. 73,000 workers at General Motors have walked off their jobs in the company's first nationwide strike in three decades. The United Auto Workers said it called for the strike after GM refused to accept the union's demand to protect workers' jobs and benefits. This is UAW President Ron Gettelfinger.
Cities and the Christian communities and...
Well, according to the Detroit Free Press, General Motors is pushing the UAW to allow it to lower labor costs by transferring responsibility for retiree health to an independent trust, freezing cost of living increases, and instituting a new level of benefits for new hires. The strike has shut down 80 General Motors facilities in 30 states. The union has nearly $900 million in its strike fund, enough to cover a two-month walkout. In Burma, tens of thousands of monks and protesters are marching through the city of Rangoon today in defiance of military orders. On Monday, Burma's military junta warned it was ready to take action against the anti-government protests that have rapidly spread across the country. The protests are the largest in Burma since 1988, when the military junta crushed a popular uprising and killed some 3,000 people. President Bush is expected to announce new sanctions against Burma today. The State Department spokesperson, Tom Casey.
We certainly would call on the regime to exercise restraint in the face of these protests and also to release those that they've imprisoned for peacefully expressing their views over the course of the last few days.
Meanwhile, in Italy, Buddhist monks held a rally Monday to show solidarity with the protesters in Burma.
I would just like to give our gesture of solidarity and support for a peaceful resolution to this very difficult situation, and for that the people can be free and can have a democratic process, and that they can earn a livelihood without being oppressed.
We'll have more on Burma later in the broadcast. In a speech at Columbia University, Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad defended Iran's right to nuclear power, but denied Iran is seeking to build nuclear weapons.
We are one of the countries that has cooperated most with the IAEA. They've had hours and weeks and days of inspections in our country, and over again, the agency reports indicate that they have not detected a deviation and that they have received positive cooperation from Iran. But regretfully, two or three monopolistic, selfish powers want to force their word on the Iranian people and deny them their right.
The Iranian president's appearance sparked widespread protests at Columbia. During the speech, Ahmadinejad was asked about Iran's attitude toward homosexuals.
In Iran, we don't have homosexuals like in your country. We don't have that in our country.
Ahmadinejad's appearance at Columbia dominated the news media on Monday. The headline in the New York Daily News read, "The evil has landed." Fox News ran a screenshot that read, quote, "Is war the only way to stop Mahmoud?" Middle East analyst Juan Cole said the demonization of the Iranian president is part of a neoconservative push for yet another war. Cole writes, quote, "The real reason his visit is controversial is that the American right has decided the United States needs to go to war against Iran. Ahmadinejad is therefore being configured as an enemy head of state. While Ahmadinejad spoke at Colombia, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon kicked off a special session on climate change at the United Nations. Ban Ki-moon said governments must take unprecedented action to reverse the trend of global warming.
We hold the future in our hands. Together, we must ensure that our grandchildren will not have to ask why we have failed to do the right things and left them to suffer the consequences. So let us send a clear and collective signal to people everywhere. Today, let the world know that you are ready to shoulder this responsibility and that you will address this challenge head on.
Over 80 heads of state attended Monday's meeting, but President Bush chose not to attend. Bush, who opposes the international treaties to address global warming, has organized a competing climate change forum later this week in Washington. Ban Ki-moon criticized the U.S. effort. He said, quote, the U.N. climate process is the appropriate forum for negotiating global action. Ivo de Boer, a top U.N. climate change official, said the Bush administration needs to be part of the global discussion.
The United States is still the largest emitter worldwide of greenhouse gases, and for that reason and for a number of others, the participation of the U.S. Is essential. At the same time, emissions in large developing countries like China, India, Brazil, South Africa are growing very fast, and to develop a future regime that doesn't also engage them in terms of limiting emissions of greenhouse gases would be pretty much meaningless.
Ivo de Boer stressed the urgency of reaching an agreement on a plan of action that would replace the Kyoto Protocol. This is John Kokut of Greenpeace.
Well, what's on the table right now and what really needs to happen is we need to have a negotiating mandate, a very clear binding mandate come out of the discussions in Indonesia. And from that, we need to see much larger greenhouse gas emissions reductions from the developed world. We need to see expanded participation from the developing world. And we need to see sort of a global agreement that in the long run, we're going to cut greenhouse gas emissions in half in order to solve this problem.
Meanwhile, newly released government documents show the Bush administration directed a behind-the-scenes effort to block California's attempt to develop its own standards to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles. Emails show Secretary of Transportation Mary Peters prodded her staff to lobby members of Congress and state governors to oppose California efforts. In news from Iraq, up to 25 people died Monday when a suicide bomber blew himself up inside a mosque during a reconciliation meeting between a Shiite and Sunni militia. The suicide bomber struck in the mixed village of Shifta, outside Bakuba. Bakuba's police chief died in the attack. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, residents of the Shiite neighborhood of Sadr City say U.S. forces have raided a number of houses. One civilian died in the raids.
We are poor people. We do not have oil. We do not have anything. They took everything from us, and they attacked us repeatedly. They burnt out this generator, which supplies us with electricity.
Two more Iraqi journalists have been killed. TV journalist Jawad Al-Dami of the satellite station Al-Baghdadiyah was shot dead in Baghdad on Sunday. Radio journalist Mohamed Ghanem Ahmed of the station Dar al-Salam was killed on Thursday in the northern city of Mosul. Protests against President Bush are planned today outside the United Nations ahead of his speech at the General Assembly. A citywide coalition of anti-war activists are forming funeral processions to march through the city to the United Nations. The demonstrators say they will commit civil disobedience by attempting to gain entry to the General Assembly in order to serve Bush with a warrant for his arrest. In education news, more than 3,200 students, faculty, and alumni at Stanford University have signed a petition to protest the appointment of former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to become a distinguished visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. The Hoover Institution is located on the Stanford campus, but is an independent think tank and research institution. The petition effort is led in part by famed psychologist Philip Zimbardo. In news from Guantanamo, a U.S. military appeals court has reinstated terrorism charges against a Canadian citizen who was first detained in Afghanistan when he was only 15 years old. In June, a military tribunal judge dismissed murder and conspiracy charges against Omar Khadr because Khadr had not been designated an unlawful enemy combatant. But on Monday, a military court overturned that decision. Khadr has been held at Guantanamo for 5 years. He turned 21 years old last Wednesday. The National Lawyers Guild has called for the release of Michael Bell and for all charges to be dropped against the Gina Six. The lawyers group urged the Justice Department to immediately convene an inquiry into the circumstances surrounding the arrests and prosecutions of the Gina Six. The Bush administration has given the Housing Authority of New Orleans the go-ahead to demolish the city's four largest public housing complexes. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development approved the demolition of the 4,500 housing units Friday. Democratic Senator Mary Landrieu criticized the ruling, but other lawmakers have endorsed such moves. Shortly after Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans, Republican Congressman Richard Baker said, quote, "We finally cleaned up public housing in New Orleans. We couldn't do it, but God did," he said. Meanwhile, in Mississippi, Oxfam America, the Mississippi NAACP, and the Mississippi Justice Center are protesting a plan to divert post-Katrina housing aid to improve the state port at Gulfport. The Mississippi Development Authority wants to take $600 million in federal funds from a housing plan for low-income homeowners hit by Hurricane Katrina and move it to spruce up the port. In economic news, Forbes has published its list of the 400 richest Americans. For the first time, 82 billionaires were not wealthy enough to make the list. The top 1% of Americans, those with incomes over $350,000, are now receiving the largest share of national income since 1928. New government statistics show police arrested a record 829,000 people for marijuana violations last year. According to the group Normal, a pot smoker is now arrested every 38 seconds in the country. The total number of marijuana arrests in the U.S. far exceeded the total number of arrests in the U.S. for all violent crimes combined, including murder, manslaughter, forcible rape, robbery, and aggravated assault. And the Federal Communications Commission has fined Comcast $4,000 for broadcasting a fake news segment on the company's CNN local news channel last year. Comcast aired a video news release produced by the manufacturer of a sleeping remedy without disclosing the company's ties to the video. This marks the first time the FCC has fined a broadcaster for airing a corporate public relations video as if it was an actual news segment. Last year, the Center for Media and Democracy released a study that found at least 77 TV stations around the country have aired corporate-sponsored video news releases over the last 10 months. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. World leaders are gathering in New York this week for the annual opening session of the UN General Assembly. With the ongoing speculation of a possible U.S. military strike on Iran, no guests are attracting as much attention as Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He opened his visit with a public forum at Columbia University. A mixed crowd of protesters turned out to greet him. One sign read, "We refuse to choose between Bush and Ahmadinejad." Democracy Now! Spoke to some of the hundreds gathered outside the lecture hall, both those protesting the Iranian president's visit and those curious to hear him for themselves. Side of the Iranian president Mahmoud Ahmadinejad at Columbia University we will play in a minute. He was invited to speak as part of Columbia's World Leader Series. Before Ahmadinejad took the podium, Columbia University President Lee Bollinger used his introductory remarks to make clear the Iranian president was not a welcome guest.
Frankly, I close with this comment, frankly, and in all candor, Mr. President, I doubt that you will have the intellectual courage to answer these questions. But your avoiding them will in itself be meaningful to us. I do expect you to exhibit the fanatical mindset that characterizes so much of what you say and do. Fortunately, I'm told by experts on your country that this only further undermines your position in Iran, with all the many good-hearted, intelligent citizens there. A year ago, I am reliably told your preposterous and belligerent statements in this country as at one of the meetings at the Council on Foreign Relations so embarrassed sensible Iranian citizens that this led to your party's defeat in the December mayoral elections. May this do that and more. I am only a professor. I am only a professor who is also a university president. And today I feel all the weight of the modern civilized world yearning to express the revulsion at what you stand for. I only wish I could do better. Thank you.
Bollinger challenged Ahmadinejad on his support for Iraqi insurgents targeting U.S. troops, his government's nuclear ambitions, and his inflammatory statements on Israel. He also chided Ahmadinejad for his comments questioning whether the Nazi Holocaust occurred.
The failures of our own government to live by our values, and we won't be shy about criticizing yours. Let's then be clear at the beginning. Mr. President, you exhibit all the signs of a petty and cruel dictator. And so I ask you, why have women, members of the Baha'i faith, homosexuals, and so many of our academic colleagues become targets of persecution in your country? Why, in a letter last week to the Secretary General of the UN, did Akbar Ghanji, Iran's leading political dissident, and over 300 public intellectuals, writers, and Nobel laureates express such grave concern that your inflamed dispute with the West is distracting the world's attention from the intolerable conditions in your regime within Iran, in particular the use of the press law to ban writers for criticizing the ruling system? Why are you so afraid of Iranian citizens expressing their opinions for change?
Colombia President Lee Bollinger. After Bollinger spoke, it was the Iranian president's turn. He began by accusing the Colombia president of insulting him and the audience. Later, he partly addressed some of the Colombia president's questions.
Why don't we encourage more research on a historical event that has become the root, the cause of many heavy catastrophes in the region in this time and age? Why shouldn't there be more research about the root causes? That was my first question. And my second question, well, given this historical event, if it is a reality, we need to still question whether the Palestinian people should be paying for it or not. After all, it happened in Europe. The Palestinian people had no role to play in it. So why is it that the Palestinian people are paying the price of an event they had nothing to do with? The Palestinian people didn't commit any crime. They had no role to play in World War II. They were living with the Jewish communities and the Christian communities in peace at the time. They didn't have any problems. And today, too, Jews, Christians, and Muslims live in brotherhood all over the world, in many parts of the world. They don't have any serious problems. But why is it that the Palestinians should pay a price, innocent Palestinians, for 5 million people to remain displaced or refugees abroad for 60 years? Or is this not a crime? Is asking about these crimes a crime in and by itself? Why should an academic myself face insults when asking questions like this? Is this what you call freedom and upholding the freedom of thought? And as for the second topic, Iran's nuclear issue, I know there's time limits, but I need time. I mean, a lot of time was taken from me. We are a country. We are a member of the International Atomic Energy Agency. For over 33 years, we were a member state of the agency. The bylaw of the agency explicitly states that all member states have the right to the peaceful nuclear fuel technology. This is an explicit statement made in the bylaw, and the bylaw says that there is no pretext or excuse. Even the inspections carried by the IAEA itself that can prevent member states' right to have that right. Of course, the IAEA is responsible to carry out inspections. We are one of the countries that's carried out the most amount of level of cooperation with the IAEA. They've had hours and weeks and days of inspections in our country. And over again, the agency's reports indicate that Iran's activities are peaceful, that they have not detected a deviation, and that Iran has, they've received positive cooperation from Iran. But regretfully, two or three monopolistic powers, selfish powers, want to force their word on the Iranian people and deny them their right.
President Ahmadinejad went on to defend his government on human rights, nuclear activities, alleged involvement in backing Iraqi insurgents. He also appeared to question whether al-Qaeda was in fact responsible for the 9/11 attacks and suggested a hidden motive. And in a statement that drew wide ridicule, Ahmadinejad replied to a question on suppression of homosexuals by claiming there were no homosexuals in Iran. For more on Ahmadinejad's visit, we will be joined by two guests, Ervand Ebrahamian, Iran expert at CUNY, City University of New York, and Trita Parsi, Treacherous Alliance is his new book. But first, we will go to break. This is Democracy Now! Stay with us. Desert Night by Khayan Khalor and Mohammed Shajarian. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman. As we go to people outside of the Columbia University Lectured Hall, hundreds gathered, both protesting the Iranian president Ahmadinejad's visit and those curious to hear for themselves.
Proud to be an American, and I'm here because I wish to witness history.
I'm here because I don't think a college campus is the place for a bigot and a terrorist to come speak to people.
Inviting him here to their private institution is a way of honoring a dictator who wants to build a nuclear weapon to use against Israel, to use against the United States.
Lucha, lucha, lucha!
My diploma is for sale at this price because its value is diminished by the actions of the university.
And to say that he is a terrorist is just doesn't make any sense. He's a freely elected leader. He has his own aims. He has his own principles, which the just because the U.S. don't agree with him doesn't mean that they can just shut him off completely.
Absolutely. I would like to hear what he has to say. I would like to hear what he has, if what he has to say is the same as what has been reported in the press.
Ahmadinejad is bad, but Bush is much worse, and humanity needs a third way. We need to stop the attack, the war in Iraq, and we need to prevent a war against Iran. Nothing that is going on in Iran will justify an attack against Iran. And the U.S. is using all this hullabaloo about Ahmadinejad to whip up public opinion for an attack against Iran.
This is making hate more than it's doing good. I think people need to open their eyes and their minds and don't put a whole country in the toilet because of what one man says. You know, Bush has a 20% approval rating in America. Ahmadinejad has less than that in Iran. So don't say, let's kill all Iranians and Iranians are bad, when it's not fair to say that about America.
It's not a question of siding with either Islamic fundamentalism, that is, the Islamic Republic of Iran, or U.S. imperialism, but rather we have to stand with the people of the world who are fighting against oppression and repression and against U.S. efforts to dominate the world.
People who were protesting for and against the visit of the Iranian president at Columbia University yesterday. For more on Ahmadinejad's visit, we're joined by two guests. Ervand Abrahamian is an Iran expert and CUNY Distinguished Professor of History at Baruch College here at the City University of New York. He's the author of several books on Iran, co-author of a new book from City Lights called Targeting Iran. And joining me from Washington, D.C. is Trita Parsi. He's the president of the National Iranian American Council, the largest Iranian American organization in the United States, author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States. First, Ervand Abrahamian, can you talk about the president's visit? Did anything he said, this is Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, surprise you?
Well, I was surprised because he didn't really use the opportunity to try to lower the tempo with the serious problem we have now, which is we're at the abyss of war, basically. And there are people pushing for war in the next few months. And this would have been a very good opportunity to try to smooth things over, try to calm the tempo down. And it's not just he who missed the opportunity. I think Bollinger missed the opportunity. In fact, Bollinger's speech was like a drumbeat for war. And most of the questions from the audience missed the opportunity. They dealt basically with important identity questions, but they didn't really deal with the issue that we are really on the abyss of war. And this is a far more serious issue than, you know, with either ethnic or gender issues. And he actually, I think, although he made some statements about Iran is not interested in nuclear weapons, he could have been more forthright and more categorical about the policies of Iran in terms of the nuclear project.
Does this remind you of Saddam Hussein before the war?
It does, in fact. Ahmadinejad didn't say it yesterday, but his policy is that there is no likelihood of war because no one in their right senses would think of invading or attacking Iran. And that's the premise he works on, which is, I think, a completely wrong premise because he doesn't seem to understand American politics. The same people who gave us the war on Iraq, the same people are running foreign policy now. But he begins from the premise that no one in their right senses would think of attacking Iran.
Trita Parsi, you have written a very interesting book, Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States. Can you take us back in time and talk about the relationship, the secret dealings between these three countries?
Well, Israel has, for a very long time, been a critical factor in America's formulation of a policy vis-a-vis Iran. But what's really interesting is that the influence of Israel has gone in completely different directions if we just go back 15 years. During the 1980s, in spite of the Iranian Revolution, in spite of Ayatollah Khomeini's many harsh remarks about Israel, far, far worse than what anything Ahmadinejad has said so far, Israel at the time was the country that was lobbying the United States to open up talks with Iran to try to rebuild the U.S.-Iran relations because of strategic imperatives that Israel had. Israel needed Iran because it was fearing the Arab world and a potential war with the Arabs. After 1991-92, that's when you see the real shift in Israeli-Iranian relations, because that's when the entire geopolitical map of the Middle East is redrawn. The Soviet Union collapses, the last standing army of the Arabs, that of Saddam Hussein, is defeated in the Persian Gulf War, and you have an entirely new security environment in the Middle East, in which the two factors, the Soviets and the Arabs, that had pushed Iran and Israel closer together, suddenly evaporate. But as their security environment improves, they also start to realize that they may be ending up in a situation in which they can become potential threats to each other. And that's when you see how the Israelis shift 180 degrees. Now the Israeli argument was that the United States should not talk to Iran because there is no such thing as Iranian moderates. And ever since, the Israelis and the pro-Israel interest in the United States have lobbied to make sure that there is no dialogue or there's no rapprochement between the United States and Iran. And the Iranians have done similar things. They have undermined every U.S. foreign policy initiative in the Middle East that they feared would be beneficial to Israel. So the real shift in Israeli-Iranian relations comes after the Cold War, not with the revolution in 1979.
But I also do want you to go right back to 1948 and talk about that period up to 1991. What were the secret relationships?
Well, immediately after Israel was founded, Iran was actually one of the states on the committee at the UN who was preparing a plan, and they were against the partition. They were against the idea of creating two states, and Iran at the time said that this would lead to several decades of crisis. But once Israel was a fact, the Iranian government felt that because it was facing a hostile Arab world, as well as a very hostile Arab ideology, pan-Arabism, Israel was a potential ally for the Iranians, particularly as Israel started to shift closer and closer to the Western camp and the United States. So throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s, the Iranians and the Israelis were working very, very closely together, had a very robust alliance. They tried to keep it secret. It wasn't necessarily very secret. But Iran never recognized Israel de jure. They recognized it de facto. They had an Israeli mission in Tehran, but they never permitted it to be called an embassy. They had an Israeli envoy to Tehran, but they never called him an ambassador. When the Israeli planes were landing at Tehran airport, they built a specific tarmac off the airport for Israeli planes to land so that no one would really see that there's so many El Al planes flying to Tehran. And the reason why the Iranians were doing this is because, on the one hand, they needed Israel as an ally because they were fearful of the Arab world. And on the other hand, they felt that if they got too close to Israel, they would only fuel Arab anger towards Iran.
Trita Parsi, you have a number of revelations in your book. One of them is that the Iranian prime minister asked Israel permission to assassinate Khomeini. Describe the circumstance.
Circumstances was right before the revolution, in which the Israelis were very, very concerned. They were fearful that the new regime would be very hostile to Israel, and they weren't certain that they would be able to build the same type of secret relations with Iran as they had during the time of the Shah. It later on turned out that they actually did have that ability, not to the same extent, but they still could do it. But the Iranian prime minister was eager to be able to get rid of Khomeini, thinking that by Khomeini being eliminated, the revolution would be able to move in a different direction. And he asked the Israelis if they could do it. Because Khomeini at the time was in Paris, the Iranians did not have the ability to do anything, but they thought that perhaps the Israelis would. The Israeli answer was apparently that this is not Israel's job and that Israel is not the policeman of the world.
What about Israel reaching out to Saddam Hussein after the Gulf War?
After the first Persian Gulf War, there was a thinking in Israel at the time that Saddam had now been weakened. He was no longer a real threat. And at the end of the day, the real potential threat in the future, the rising power, was Iran. So the Israelis were trying to find different ways of being able to find some sort of a modus vivendi with Saddam Hussein. This significantly angered the Clinton administration that was pursuing a policy of isolating both Iran and Iraq at the same time. And they were very annoyed that the Israelis were trying to find some sort of a relationship with Saddam in the midst of all of that. Now, the Israeli initiative didn't go anywhere, but it was guided by the thinking that Iran was going to be the major threat. And even though Iran at the time really was not a threat to Israel, Israel already at that time treated it as an actual threat.
The United States foiling Iran's plan to withdraw support from Hamas and Hezbollah.
We talked about that before, that there was a 2003 proposal that the Iranians sent over to the United States trying to find a larger accommodation between the United States and Iran, in which they basically put all the different issues on the table, including offer within the framework of the negotiations to disarm Hezbollah and turn it into a mere political organization. Had that happened, there would probably not have been a war last year between Israel and Lebanon. Secondly, to end all support for Islamic Jihad and Hamas and encourage the Palestinians to go a political route rather than a military route in their dealings with Israel. But what's revealed in the book as well, that has not been out in the media a lot, is that prior to giving this proposal to the United States, the Iranians were fishing it around in Europe, trying to create some support for it. And most importantly, they went to places that they knew Israelis were going to be, and they were presenting the framework, the concept of this grand bargain. And they wanted to make sure that the Israelis felt that this would not be something that would come at their expense, because they were concerned that the Israelis would try to undermine it. So they were basically sending a signal, look, if we can have this accommodation with the United States, we will disentangle and basically not be so involved in the Israeli-Palestinian issue anymore.
Trita Parsi is author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States. Our guest also, Ervand Abrahamian, Iran expert, distinguished professor at Baruch College. I wanted Professor Abrahamian to read from Juan Cole's piece, who says, talking about Ahmadinejad, he's been depicted as a Hitler figure intent on killing Israeli Jews, even though he's not commander-in-chief of the Iranian armed forces, has never invaded any other country, denies he is an anti-Semite, has never called for any Israeli civilians to be killed, and allows Iran's 20,000 Jews to have representation in parliament. That Khatami is the one with Khamenei is the one with the real power.
He's right on target, yes. I think Juan Cortes sums it up. And the question is then, why is in American politics so much focused on Ahmadinejad? I think he serves the function that Saddam Hussein played. He's an easy person to demonize. Yesterday's Bollinger's introduction, when he described him as a dictator, I think shows how little people like Bollinger really know about the Iranian political system. One can call Ahmadinejad many things, but a dictator he is by no means. He can't even, he doesn't even have the power to appoint his own cabinet ministers. It's a presidency with very limited power. And to claim that he is in a position to threaten the United States or Israel is just bizarre, frankly. I think someone like Bollinger should know more about Iran before they sling around smears like terms such as dictator.
We'll talk about Khamenei, then, if he is the one with real power.
He is supreme leader, but the Iranian system is actually very sort of collective leadership. The foreign policy is made in a council where the supreme leader appoints those members, but there are very different views there. And Ahmadinejad does not run that committee. Someone like Rafsanjani has a great deal of influence. The former president, Khatami, has a great deal of influence. And they are much more willing to negotiate. In fact, they were, I think, the people who offered this grand bargain in 2003 to settle all the issues with the United States. And for reasons that are not clear, the White House just basically brushed it aside. They were not interested in pursuing this. And this is why it leads me to think that this administration is adamant in resolving the nuclear problem by military force, because if it was interested in resolving it through diplomacy, there were offers made to follow that route. And they have very consciously decided not to follow the diplomatic route. So if you don't follow the diplomatic route, the only other route there is the military route. And it's only a question of time when they decide on airstrikes.
I wanted to ask you, Trita Parsi, about this Newsweek magazine report that says that Vice President Cheney considered provoking an exchange of military strikes between Iran and Israel in order to give the U.S. a pretext to attack Iran. A few months before he quit, the Middle East advisor to Cheney, David Wormser, told a small group of people that Cheney had been mulling the idea of pushing for limited Israeli missile strikes against the Iranian nuclear site at Natanz and perhaps other sites in order to provoke Tehran into lashing out, citing two knowledgeable sources. Newsweek put out this report. Your response?
I think it's definitely a plausible scenario, because one thing that we know for with great certainty is that the Israelis lack the military capability to take out Iran's nuclear program. They can attack it, but they cannot destroy it. And the only thing that it would result to is some sort of Iranian retaliation, which would then suck the United States right into the conflict, because the United States would not be able to stand without it, outside of it, and obviously many elements in the White House would probably prefer to immediately get into it. One of the things that I describe in the book that I think is extremely important is that when you take a look at how Iran has made its decision vis-a-vis Israel, it's actually been geopolitical and geostrategic factors that have been driving their decisions. It's not been ideology. And I think this is a critical point, because right now you have a metaphor being presented by Bibi Netanyahu, the leader of the Likud party, in which he's saying that it's 1938 and Iran is Germany. And then he goes on to imply that Ahmadinejad is Hitler. If we accept that premise, that it is 1938, that Iran is Germany and Ahmadinejad is Hitler, then which leader in his or her right mind would want to play the role of Neville Chamberlain? It's a metaphor whose premises basically puts us in a situation in which conflict is completely inevitable, and there's no other way, because negotiations and diplomacy simply cannot be pursued. Fortunately, this is a false premise. Iran and Israel and the United States and Israel are not engaged in an ideological zero-sum game battle. This is a strategic rivalry. It is solvable, but it requires a tremendous amount of diplomacy to be able to find a way out of it. And unfortunately, right now, diplomacy is the last thing that one can describe the foreign policies of these countries, particularly the Bush administration.
I interviewed exiled Iranian activist Azar Darakhshan earlier this summer. She's the editor of the Women of March 8th magazine and helped organize the 2006 European March Against Anti-Woman Laws in Iran. I just want to play an excerpt from my conversation with her. This is Azar Darakhshan.
I have seen our portrait in the media, Western media. In the media, there is two sides. There is the United States and government of Iran. There are clashes. And the people, the voice of people is absent completely. And the opinion of foreigner opinion, they think the destiny, the future of the Iran is going decided by these two powers. And try to tell to the people in foreigner countries, in European countries, it's not true, this portrait. There is another factor, very important. The people of Iran, the movement, they are going to take the future. We are not forced to choose between neither the United States, neither the government of Iran. There is another force in Iran. If really somebody wants to prevent the war, the clashes, it should be support this movement for equality, for freedom. We don't need United States liberate us. First of all, we are here, and this is all legitimate to liberate ourselves. We want to decide about our future ourselves. We want to fight our native enemy by ourselves. We don't need, that's first. Second one, we already have seen, because the Afghanistan and Iraq, they are neighbor of Iran. And the women of Iran, they can see it. Maybe before not, but right now it's enough to know what kind of program they have for the people of Iran.
Iranian dissident Azar Darakhshan. Professor Abrahamian, your response.
Well, I think she's right in that Iran is a very complicated society. There are very different political movements. And the idea that somehow it's a frozen system that is not going to change, it already precludes any type of a possibility of negotiations and changes. In fact, Iranian system has an electoral system. We're going to come up with elections very soon. There is no guarantee that Ahmadinejad would be reelected again. It's very possible that reformers, liberals, would get into power again.
When is the election?
In less than 2 years' time. The base, in fact, of Ahmadinejad's, I would say the core base, is very similar to Bush's core base. It's about 25%. For him to get reelected, he has to stretch out and find independence and others. And this is going to be very hard. If the reformers can actually get rally around one candidate, as they did in the 1990s, they could have landslide victories in which over 70% of the electorate was voting for liberals and reformers.
And what direction would a U.S. attack on Iran push the election?
Oh, it would play right into the hands of Ahmadinejad, because you'd have a national emergency. He would declare basically the country's in danger. Everyone would have to rally around the flag. People who disliked him would keep their mouth shut at a time of when the existence of the state is in question. You don't mess around with leaders. He would basically be able to act as the as a much more strongman national leader.
Srita Parsi, you've had unusual access to U.S. decision makers, Israeli decision makers, Iranian leaders. What is your sense of a strike, the U.S. or Israel, on Iran? Is it imminent?
Well, I don't think an Israeli strike is imminent unless there is some sort of coordination with the United States with the aim of being able to draw the U.S. into the conflict. I do believe that some sort of a conflict between the United States and Iran is quite probable right now, mindful of the lack of diplomacy that is taking place. And I also do believe that this is not necessarily something that will go away automatically just because there's going to be a change of government in the United States within the next 2 years. Many of the decisions that are made right now have the impact of limiting the maneuverability of future administrations. We're making it more and more difficult, not only for this administration, but also for future administrations to pursue diplomacy. And what we're seeing in the Middle East right now is not necessarily just a conflict over what's going on in Iraq or about Iran's nuclear program. This is a conflict that, at the end of the day, is about two powerhouses in the region, and it's a conflict about hegemony, for lack of a better word. And these type of shifts, with the United States currently declining and finding itself in a more and more difficult situation in Iraq, and with Iran finding itself in a stronger position and acting very, very confidently, these type of shifts historically do not take place peacefully unless there is a tremendous amount of diplomacy. And again, we're not seeing that right now. And I'm very concerned that even if we may manage to avoid war for the next 2 years, the next U.S. administration may find itself in a position in which its maneuverability is so limited that the military option once again becomes a very viable one for them.
Could Ahmadinejad be playing a game like Saddam Hussein, where if it is clear he doesn't have nuclear weapons, he's weaker, the U.S. would be more likely to attack? He looks at the example of North Korea, where they do have nuclear weapons, and now the U.S. is just pursuing a diplomatic option.
I think there's a combination of two. On the one hand, I think a lot of his statements and his behavior is aimed to be a deterrent against the United States. He's acting confident, and he's talking about the United States not being able to attack. This is a way of saying that the U.S. can't do it, and if you do it, you will face a tremendously difficult situation. So he's doing this partly to as a deterrence. It has the negative impact of scaring the daylights out of a lot of people, including a lot of Iran's neighbors that are now gravitating towards the United States' position because they're very fearful of what Ahmadinejad may be capable of doing. At the same time, I do believe that to a certain extent, but not fully, he has actually convinced himself that Iran is in such a strong position, the United States is in such a weak position that it can't do it. But I think it's a combination of these two, and I think it's important to keep in mind that most of the belligerence that he's doing is probably for the purpose of deterrence, not necessarily as an offensive strategy.
Iran's role in Iraq?
Sorry?
Iran's role in Iraq?
I think the Iranians have played a game in Iraq in which they basically have invested in every potential faction in Iraq, making sure that whoever comes up on top is going to be a player who has strong relations with Iran, because it's in Iran's hardcore national interest to make sure that Iraq never again becomes a hostile state, so they never have to experience the 8-year war that they had with Iraq in the 1980s. So, again, I think we're seeing a policy in the by the Iranian government there that is quite independent of whether Ahmadinejad is in power or not. It's probably something that another Iranian government would be pursuing as well, at least under this regime that we're having in Iran right now. And I think the only way for the United States to be able to find a way out of Iraq is not only to talk to the Iranians, but really include all of the other neighbors of Iraq into the process, giving these neighbors not only a stake in the outcome, but also a stake in the process itself. We have a tremendous amount of problems with what the Saudis are doing in Iraq and also what the Jordanians are doing. We're not talking about that at all. On the contrary, we're just focusing on Iran's role.
Saudi's role? I think very briefly.
Saudi's role. Well, a military report just came out about 2 months ago, was leaked in the LA Times, that showed that about 45% of all the suicide bombers in Iraq are Saudi nationals. We've known for quite some time that there's a lot of money flowing in to Iraq from Saudi Arabia that is going to the Sunni insurgents, because their belief is that they're fighting a war against Sunnis and Shiites in Iraq. We're not talking about that. On the contrary, Saudi Arabia got praised by Ambassador Crocker during his testimony. And I think it's a very one-sided way of looking at the problems we're facing in Iraq. And as long as we pursue a very political perspective on the Iraqi situation, then I fear that we will continue to be in a rather difficult mess over there.
Trita Parsi, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your book, Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States. And a final question to Professor Abrahamian. Are you afraid for your people? Are you afraid for the people of Iran?
Yes, I'm very much concerned that in the next few months there will be airstrikes. I think what we are... saw before in with Iraq, we're having a rerun of that. So very much the same rhetoric, the same type of people are pushing for war, and using even the same sort of arguments that often unsubstantiated arguments blown out of proportion. For instance, the constant drumbeat that Iran is actually supplying weaponry to the insurgents that are killing Americans. This is basically saying that Iran has already declared war on the United States. When you try to actually pin down what is the evidence for that, it boils down to the yellow cake stories and the stuff about Saddam Hussein being behind al-Qaeda. And until the United States actually gets real evidence that Iran is providing lethal weapons to the insurgents, I would not accept any of those arguments at face value.
Professor Abrahamian, thank you as well for being with us. Ervand Abrahamian is author of the book Targeting Iran. When we come back, we'll look at what is happening right now in Burma. Stay with us. Buddhist chant here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Burma, the ruling military junta is facing the most vocal popular uprising against its rule in nearly two decades. Tens of thousands of monks and civilians have defied military warnings and have staged new anti-government protests. On Tuesday in the city of Rangoon, as many as 100,000 people took to the streets. A day earlier, Buddhist monks dressed in maroon robes have been leading the marches. They vowed to continue holding marches until they've, quote, wiped the military dictatorship from the land. The protests are the largest in Burma since 1988, when the military junta crushed a popular uprising by killing some 3,000 people. Over the weekend, monks marched to the home of the Nobel Peace Laureate, pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi, who's been under house arrest since 2003. Military authorities allowed Suu Kyi to briefly greet and pray with the monks. It was her first public appearance in more than 4 years. On Monday, the ruling junta warned it was ready to take action against the monks to break the protests. It repeated its warning in state media Tuesday, ordering monks not to get involved in politics, accusing them of allowing themselves to be manipulated by the foreign media. President Bush is expected to announce new sanctions on the Burmese junta in a speech today. This is State Department spokesperson Tom Casey.
We certainly would call on the regime to exercise restraint in the face of these protests and also to release those that they've imprisoned for peacefully expressing their views over the course of the last few days.
Jeremy Woodrum is co-founder of the U.S. Campaign for Burma. He's helped spearhead a successful nationwide boycott of the Burmese military government and organized delegations to visit refugee camps near the Burma-Thailand border. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Jeremy, what is the latest? What is happening on the streets of Burma today?
Well, I've been on the phone all night, and apparently inside Burma, in the capital city, an additional 100,000 people, monks, civilians, students, and everyday civilians are marching against the military regime. Also, what's not being reported as widely in the media is that demonstrations are taking place across the country. In one other city alone, at least 50,000 additional people were marching there as well. So things are growing every day.
What do you think is going to happen?
I think the protests are one of two things. Either the protests are going to get much, much larger, or the military regime is going to crack down. Unfortunately, we've received some ominous news that the military is preparing a crackdown. They've ordered some soldiers in the military to shave their heads so that they could pose as monks, and then those fake monks would attack soldiers to incite a military crackdown. The regime has done this before in Burma, and we believe they would do so again.
And what is happening? Has the regime changed in letting Aung San Suu Kyi be shown? And tell us what is happening with the Nobel laureate.
Sure. Well, that was a very emotional time for her and for the people of Burma. You know, for the Burmese people, Aung San Suu Kyi is like Nelson Mandela. She singularly embodies their hopes and aspirations. Very uncommon to find someone like that anywhere in the world, in any country, but she is it. And apparently, for a brief period of time, the regime relaxed their restrictions on her. She's been under complete house arrest for the past 4 years and allowed monks to march past her house. When they met her, she started crying because she was overwhelmed with the emotions, I believe, of seeing the courage and bravery of the Burmese people. They continue to act nonviolently in the face of severe repression.
Just remind us what happened in 1988 when the people rose up like they have this week.
Yeah, well, the circumstances were very similar. The causes were very similar. And the military regime reacted by opening fire on nonviolent demonstrators. So keep in mind, not a single demonstrator has done anything, thrown a single rock, stone, used violence in the least. And in 1988, there was a similar situation, and the regime executed between—we don't know the exact number—somewhere between 3 and 10,000 people. They just opened fire on demonstrators in the streets, and we greatly fear that happening again.
And President Bush calling apparently today for more sanctions on Burma?
Yeah, that is an important step. We should squeeze the military leaders on their personal finances, and that's what those sanctions are. But at the same time, the real thing that needs to be done is the United Nations Security Council needs to step in and take action. They are the body in the world that has the power to restrain Burma's military regime. The problem is that China has almost single-handedly and unilaterally paralyzed the UN Security Council. They haven't made a single statement. They haven't made a single resolution. They have done absolutely nothing. They're just sitting on the sidelines while Burma burns. It's hugely frustrating to see one country, China, be able to block the entire will of the international community.
Jeremy Widgerman, thank you for being with us with the U.S. Campaign for Burma. We'll certainly continue to follow events there. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Aaron Mate, Angelique Kamat, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Kari Mache, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.